To keep a baby entertained, parents often need to introduce new objects or toys every couple of minutes. When you do that, you're not just distracting the baby, you're helping them learn about the world. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Today we'll find out about new research into how infants learn. John Spencer is a professor of psychology at the University of Iowa. He's just published an article reporting what he's discovered about how infants create knowledge by looking at their world. Then Paul Etri will be here. He's written about his friendship with the remarkable Dr. Ignacio Ponseti in the new book, Ponseti and Paul. He'll share his memories with us. Join our conversation after the news. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. Good morning. I'm Charity Nebbe. Later this hour, I'll talk with Paul Etri, who's written about his friendship with the remarkable Dr. Ignacio Ponseti in the new book, Ponseti and Paul. But first, we're going to start by talking about babies. Babies learn remarkably fast. Think of all the skills and knowledge that a child acquires in just this year. The problem is babies tell us how they learn. And my first guest today can share some insight into how that happens. John Spencer is a professor of psychology at the University of Iowa. He's just published an article about how babies learn in the journal Cognitive Science. Hello, John.
Hi.
Thank you so much for being here today.
Thanks for having me.
First, let's start with what you were hoping to discover. When you started your research, what question were you hoping to answer?
Well, there's been a long history in the field of psychology of studying how infants learn, and actually some of the pioneering work happened here at the University of Iowa, looking at how actually infants look and how looking changes as infants learn about the world. So there's been this long history, and one of the things that changed over the course of 50 years of studying how infants look and learn is there was a shift from focusing on kind of the basics of looking and learning about objects to really focusing in on cognition, right? How the, you know, thinking changes as infants explore the world. And interestingly, the looking part got lost. And so what our paper really focuses on tries to bring the history of the field kind of full circle to say that looking is an important part of the learning process. And we need to figure out ways to integrate looking and learning. And that's what the theory we present in this paper does.
How did you actually set about researching that? Because, again, we can look at a child. We can think we know what they're thinking and what they're doing. But an infant can't tell us. How do you study what a baby is looking at?
Yeah. Well, classically, people have used a paradigm called habituation, which has been around forever. And we can, for example, show an infant, what we use in my lab are stimuli we affectionately call buggles. Okay, these are stimuli that have a color and a particular shape and maybe a little head and feet. And so we show the infants buggle number one over and over and over again, and they'll look at it, and then they'll look away, and they'll look again. Then they'll look at their feet, and then they'll look again. And over time, they'll gradually start looking less and less. And then we can show them a buggle that, for example, has a different color. And if infants can tell the difference between buggle one and buggle two, they'll start looking at buggle two a lot more.
Because it's new.
Because it's
interesting.
New. Right. Wildly exciting.
Right. Well, and as I mentioned in the beginning of the show, I think every parent, everybody who's ever babysat has had that experience where you have an infant and you show them an object and they're very interested for a while and then suddenly completely uninterested in that object. But so you're constantly looking for new things. So that was really the experience that you were recreating in the lab.
Yeah, and the really cool thing about what we've been working on is, you know, classically in the lab, we show infants one thing. Well, we want to know, what if there's a real world out there, right? What if there are many opportunities for infants to look at objects, many things, in, let's say, on a tabletop in front of them? How does their looking behavior actually drive their learning behavior and vice versa?
How old were the infants that you were studying?
Well, the paper that that we're talking about started with infants as young as 6 weeks and did computer simulations of the looking behavior of 6-week-olds. all the way up to about a year of age. So that's kind of the time period we're focusing in on.
And when they come into the lab, how do you control what's happening? Do they come in, do their parents show them these objects, or is that something that a lab technician or someone in your lab would do?
Yeah, we have a bunch of different tasks we might put infants in, and they come into the lab, they'll sit on the parents' lap, and we give the parents little blackout glasses so they can't see what's going on, and give them some nice music to listen to. And then we have basically a large screen in front of them, and we can do a variety of different things where we might show some objects really quick and ask how they orient their attention, for example, to an object. Or we might present a learning situation where we might have two things on either side of the screen and give them opportunities to look back and forth. And then behind the screen, we have lab technicians in my lab who are coding where infants are looking, you know, from millisecond to millisecond, essentially.
Okay, so I was wondering about that because, of course, every parent has a different style of interacting with their child, and some parents can make an object seem very exciting.
Right, yeah.
And other parents may not have that unique talent. As the children are looking at these objects, and you talked about creating a computer simulation, what are you at with their attention? Are you studying their eye patterns?
Yeah, we're looking at basically where they look, from second to second, a look to the left, a look away, a look to the right, back to the left, how long they dwell in each look, right? And then how those shifting patterns and those dwell patterns change over the course of learning. And then by bringing infants in either longitudinally, so studying the same infant repeatedly over time, or by bringing different groups of infants in, we can get a sense of how, you know, the sort of micro details of looking relate to learning in the lab, relate to development outside of the lab.
Okay. And when you're talking about learning in this case, it's
real basic, right? Learning that, remember, Buggle 1 was that red thing and Buggle 2 was the blue thing.
Okay, right. So learning to recognize.
Yeah, learning to recognize
what you're presenting them with. And do you, when you bring babies into the lab over a longitudinal study, mm-hmm. are you looking to see if they remember what they've seen before?
In some research has looked at that. So you might bring an infant in 1 week and then bring them in a week later and ask, do they remember what they learned last time they were in the lab? And kind of surprisingly, they do. But we usually show them different objects each time they come into the lab. And what we're really interested in is kind of an infant coming in early on who might show a particular pattern of exploring the world. Does that pattern of exploring the world kind of stay with the infant over time? And how does that change? So what are those individual differences in kind of looking and learning that we can identify?
So in this study, the paper that you just published in Cognitive Science, what is your conclusion? What did you find out about how infants look and learn?
Well, we essentially proposed a model for how the process unfolds. And, if you think about an infant exploring, let's say they come into the lab and there's a bunch of toys on the table, right? What our model says is the first time they look somewhere, it may be just random, or it may be that there's a particularly salient object, like the parent picks an object up and moves it, right? That's great at grabbing attention. Now, the infant then looks there, and that starts a memory process going, okay? And they start to learn about the features of that object, for example. And as they encode that object into what we call a working memory state, that then sends a signal back to the fixation system to sort of look elsewhere. Sort of like, I've got that, now let's explore something else. And there's lots of subtle factors that can drive that fixation process around. Could be that the parent picks up another object and moves that, right? Well, that drags attention over there, and now the infant starts to learn about that object. And then the final piece of the puzzle is, as you get into that working memory state, you leave a little memory trace that kind of lingers. And that's that longer-term learning that we're really interested in. So we sort of essentially put together a model that describes how all this stuff works together and how those memory traces can build up, you know, week by week by week over development to really create change.
And let's take this into the real world. And one of the things in reading about this, it's fascinating, but I also think about babies in the real world, and they don't just look at stuff. Mm-hmm. They touch stuff. They put it in their mouths. They throw it. So I can only imagine they're gathering a lot more information when they actually have a tactile experience as well. How do you separate looking from touch?
Well, I would say we don't want to separate it. We want to think about sort of the integrated whole of the infant's experience. And in this paper, we focused on visual learning because that's the history of studying this stuff in the laboratory. But the cool thing is the theory that we created, or this computer model that we created, can be generalized to bring in tactile information, auditory information. I mean, if you think about, a simple interaction with like a rattle, right? You get auditory information, tactile. Obviously, you know, the infant's going to stick it in their mouth despite your best efforts, right? Because it was just on the floor.
Right.
And that's a very, what I call, high-dimensional experience, right? There's all this rich experience out there, even in this just simple thing of picking up a rattle, bringing it to your mouth, right, and hearing it, hearing the sound it makes. And our theory really brings all that stuff together and then says, how does that carry forward week by week by week to create learning and change?
And how does that work? That is the big question.
Yeah.
But
well, I think I would say one of the things we're learning in development is the power of big numbers. Okay, so for example, just if we go back to the looking modality, right, and visual learning. So by 2.5 months, infants have made over 2.5 million eye movements, right? And by 3.5 months, it's up to 3 to 6 million. So that's a huge number of eye movements. And every look, right, brings in a lot of information about the world. And so there's all these massive opportunities to learn step by step by step and really kind of figure out what are the statistics of my world? What are the things that are most prevalent? To learn that, cats have these pointy ears and they have these whiskers and they have characteristic tails, whereas dogs have these long snouts and dogs drool and cats don't, and, that richness of experience. So step by step, they're pulling all that stuff together and moving forward.
We're talking about how infants learn today. John Spencer is a professor of psychology at the University of Iowa. He's just published an article about how babies learn in the journal Cognitive Science. He's particularly been looking at how they learn through looking. We'll continue our conversation in a moment. And coming up later this hour, I'll talk with Paul Etri, who's written about his friendship with Dr. Ignacio Ponseti in the new book Ponseti and Paul. We'll talk about his memories in a few minutes. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Coming up later this hour, we'll talk about the legendary Dr. Ignacio Ponseti, who's famous for his revolutionary treatment of clubfoot in infants. I'll talk to Paul Etri, who was a very good friend of his for a couple of decades and has written about their friendship in the new book Ponseti and Paul. That's coming up in a few minutes, but right now, John Spencer is with me. He's a professor of psychology at the University of Iowa. He's just published an article about how babies learn through looking in the journal Cognitive Science, and you're welcome to join our conversation at 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. If you have questions about how this plays out in the real world, or maybe some things that you've observed with your own children. And again, we are jumping into the real world, but how do you expect, or how do you think the information that you've gathered and this mathematical model you've been able to put together, computer simulations, how can this be used by people who are studying child development and actually working with kids?
Right. So there's a lot of interest right now in early intervention. Given the pace of change early in development, the idea is if we could identify kids at risk very early on, we could capitalize on that, give infants just the right experiences, let's say in the first year, and that might bring them on to a more positive developmental trajectory. Okay, So there's a couple challenges in doing this. The first is identifying infants at risk. Okay, and we could do that in a couple key cases. So there's a lot of interest in infants born prematurely, as well as siblings of children diagnosed with an autism spectrum disorder. These are two groups we can identify who are clearly at risk for, you know, later developmental disorders, special needs in the classroom, et cetera. But, you know, at the end of the day, what you need to do is really tell parents what to do, right? What are they supposed to do to intervene early? And to do that requires, I think, a deep understanding of how learning and development work in infancy. And so that's really what our model is all about. It gives researchers a tool to understand what are those micro details that are going on as a parent is interacting with an infant. So I'll give you one concrete example. So in the paper, one of the things we did is we created two contexts for our infant model. Okay, one was a responsive context, and one was a non-responsive context. So we put both models were identical. And in the responsive model, we put it in an environment with lots of objects out there in the world. And when that model looked at an object, there was a little bit of a boost in the input, okay, at that location. So it's as if the model happened to look at this particular toy over here on the left, and the parent, let's say, called attention to that toy, maybe jiggled it, maybe talked about it, used their lovely sing-songy voices, whatever. Mm-hmm. Just to highlight it, and that helped that responsive model dwell a little bit longer on that object. The non-responsive environment was essentially the opposite. So when that model looked at the toy over here on the left, there was a little bit of an increase in the input for other objects out there in the visual world, a little bit of a distraction. Okay, so imagine the infant's looking over here on the left, and the parent maybe jiggles the toy on the right. Well, what we found is just by creating the smallest little bias in this virtual environment, those two models learned very differently. And the one in the responsive environment not only learned more, but it learned better. Okay, so not only did it learn about, you know, colors and shapes and things like that, but it was better at discriminating known objects from novel objects. Okay, so the idea would be now we have a tool that, say, a clinician could use, where we could actually even tune up our model to be exactly like that preterm infant, to have the same looking patterns at 6 weeks that preterm infant has. And now we could actually run the model through intervention studies and say, okay, which ones optimize development? Which produce the best outcomes? Which take that preterm infant and not only help it learn more, but learn better? And those are the types of things we're working on now.
So you're making a leap from with children at risk in the past. The advice has often been, you know, interact with your child as much as possible, which is really advice for every parent. Right. But now you could be able to say, if you interact in this specific way with this specific pattern, then your time, your energy can have far greater dividends.
Yeah. And I think the really cool thing also is not only could we say interact in this particular way, but, you know, we're not just going to say interact in that way and we're going to leave you alone, right? Come in a couple of months and we'll test that infant in our lab tasks. And our model predicts your infant should be here. And if your infant isn't here, then we'll work together and figure out how to change things, how to optimize that intervention so that the next time we look at them, mm-hmm. they really are where we expect them to be.
Now, your mathematical model can show how quickly children acquire knowledge and have a predictable pattern, but kids are all different.
Right.
Does that pattern really hold up from infant to infant?
Yeah, that's the other really exciting thing is it's notoriously hard in studies of premature infants to have a positive outcome because of vast individual differences, right? Every infant is different. Well, the nice thing is we can actually sort of create an individual model. That's at the end of the day what our model is all about. It's about individuals, not about groups. So we use group data to sort of validate the model and get nice publications out of it. But at the end of the day, what we care about is individuals. And we really think we can, you know, there are, for example, parameters in our model that we can tune up to be, yeah, this is Joey and this is Johnny and this is Jill. And then we can proceed from there to study development.
I'm sure that there are many people who work with at-risk infants who are very interested in your research. A lot of parents are going to be very interested in your research. Do you also have toy companies calling you and saying, hey, how can we make the most interesting toy for a baby?
We do not have toy companies beating down our door. It's funny to see all the trends in toys and how they change from, you know, you have the black and white mobiles, and then it's like primary colors and different fads. But we haven't gotten into that world yet.
All right, not yet.
Yeah.
What's the next question you want to answer?
Well, one of the next things we're looking at is to not only look at infants behaviorally, but we're also measuring brain activity at the same time. So the models we use neural networks that we think are mimicking properties of actual neural networks in the brain. And we have a new neuroimaging system called near-infrared spectroscopy, where we literally take infrared laser light and shine it into infants' brains. Completely safe, but sounds like a lot of fun.
Right?
We're measuring brain activity as infants are doing our tasks. And that's another, potentially powerful tool, because we could look at not only infants behaviorally, but are we actually capturing characteristics of the brain? And for infants who have, let's say, brain damage early on, can we really implement that in our models and predict where they should be?
Is it challenging to recruit enough infants for your studies?
Absolutely. So if you ever get a letter as a parent from the psychology department, please say yes. We need you. You are vitally important to our research. Absolutely.
What kind of commitment does it take for a parent and a baby? And the babies may have a little more free time on their hands, but to get involved in one of these studies?
Usually the commitment is about 30, 45 minutes. So we bring the family into the lab, make sure everybody's comfortable, answer any questions the parents would have. And then the actual tasks typically take about 12 minutes. Because, infants can't handle too much.
Right.
We just finished a big longitudinal study where the commitment was more like an hour or so in the lab. And thank you to all those parents who came in. So we're just processing the data now. But parents are vitally important to everything we do.
Well, I can't wait to see what else you come up with.
Great.
John, thank you so much for your time today.
Thanks for having me.
John Spencer is a professor of psychology at the University of Iowa. We've just put up a link to the paper that he published on our Facebook page at Iowa Public Radio. This is Talk of Iowa. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. And now we're going to shift gears, although we're going to start by talking about infants today, because that is where Dr. Ignacio Pansetti focused his research and his life's work. With me today is Paul Etri, who was a very good friend of the legendary Dr. Ignacio Pansetti. When they met, Dr. Pansetti was already world famous for his treatment of clubfoot in infants. In fact, he was already past retirement age, but the two men still shared more than two decades of a remarkable friendship. Paul Etri has written about that friendship in the new book, Pansetti and Paul, Conversations with the Legendary Ignacio Pansetti, revealing a unique insight into the masterminds of the Second World War. Paul, thank you so much for being with us today.
It's my pleasure. Thank you.
Tell me about when you first met Dr. Pansetti.
When I first met Dr. Pansetti was about 25 years ago, and he was, as you said, quite known for the creation of the Pansetti method. And at that time, he had patients from all over the world. And the first week I was at work, he invited me to visit his clinic, and there was a young mother from Denmark who brought her baby daughter to him, And he asked me to come to his clinic and observe the way he treated that young patient. And it was just remarkable, and he made a big impression on me, because when I first saw that baby and when I saw her foot, she was about several weeks old, and then I saw the mother standing there with tears in her eyes because that was her first baby, and the foot was totally deformed. It was the toes were inverted into the sole of the foot. And I actually whispered in Dr. Panseri's ear, I said, there is no way this is going to be normal. He said, Paul, wait and see, wait and see. And then he spent about half an hour manipulating and examining the foot. In fact, he was so focused and concentrating that beads of sweat came down his forehead. And then after half an hour, the mother was actually sobbing at that time. He turned to her and he said, don't worry. In a few weeks, your baby's foot will be as perfect as the rest of her. And indeed, in about 8 weeks, that's what happened.
For people who don't know about Dr. Ponseti, you mentioned the Ponseti method, which was named for him and for his treatment of clubfoot in infants until he came along. Clubfoot had been treated with surgery.
That's correct.
And the surgery was risky.
Very.
And often children would be crippled for life.
Absolutely. And I have seen actually videos and pictures and patients of those patients, babies who have been treated by surgery. And it wasn't successful. Most of them aren't, because of the tenderness of the ligaments in the baby's foot. And many of them actually have walked on their feet and knees because they couldn't use the foot.
Dr. Ponseti developed a method for treating clubfoot that was non-surgical. Can you
right.
talked about him spending a half an hour manipulating the child's foot,
right.
and then there would be weeks of that? Explain the
sure.
method a little bit for
sure.
us.
Let me take a step backwards. When Dr. Ponseti was young, about 8, 9, 10 years old in Spain, his dad was a watchmaker. And his dad forced him to learn the art of making watches. He told me later that even though he resented his dad doing that at the time, but that was a blessing in disguise, because the baby's foot was as intricate as the inside of a watch. And the ligaments had to be straightened out very gingerly, very tenderly. And what he did, he created a method by using a series of casts, just like an artist. And he would apply a cast for 1 week. And then the next week, he would remove it and then straighten the leg a few inches and apply another cast. And after about 8 or 10 casts, which may take about 2 or 3 months, the foot would straighten out. And actually, you can't tell the difference between the good one and the bad one.
And it would just develop normally from that point on.
It was developed normally. In fact, one of our doctors, Jim Napola, his son, Chris, was born with a club foot. And Dr. Napola was very frantic. He called Dr. Ponseti at night, and Dr. Ponseti told him, don't worry. We will take care of it. Chris now is about, let's see, he just started college. He became a superstar at Regina High School here. He played both track and field and football. He's a big fellow, incredible athlete, and his foot is very normal.
So, as I mentioned, when you first met Dr. Ponseti, he was past retirement age, and he had even tried to retire?
He retired at age 65, and then he actually went to the university and got a couple of degrees, one in art and one in writing. And in fact, he did do some painting. His house was full of paintings. Picasso, you know, Picasso was actually, he knew Picasso and Picasso's mother when he was going to school in Barcelona. And he had pictures in his house, paintings of Picasso. And then he had his own picture. And then I always would, when I go to his house, I tell him, yours, Dr. Ponseti, is the best. You beat Picasso. And he was very happy. He was a very humble person. You know, charity, he was what I call a Renaissance man. Renaissance man don't age. Renaissance man grow and keep up with everything. He was way ahead of his time. He was a combination of Picasso, of Einstein, and of Mother Teresa. He just combined all of these. And he was very humble. And I loved him. I became addicted to him for 25 years. We went out for lunches. We went out for dinners. And the night I won't go out with him, I become restless. In fact, now, actually, I miss him very much.
We'll talk more in a moment. I'm talking to Paul Etri, and he has written about his friendship with the remarkable Dr. Ignacio Ponseti in the new book, Ponseti and Paul, Conversations with the Legendary Ignacio Ponseti, Revealing a Unique Insight into the Masterminds of the Second World War. And we'll continue our conversation in a moment. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. My guest right now is Paul Etri, and he has written about his decades-long friendship with Dr. Ignacio Ponseti, who was world-famous for his revolutionary treatment of clubfoot in infants. He created a non-surgical treatment for clubfoot called the Ponseti Method that could help a child develop completely normally. And of course, he was at the University of Iowa for many years. That's where these two men met and became friends. Paul Etri has written about that friendship in the new book, Ponseti and Paul, Conversations with the Legendary Ignacio Ponseti, Revealing a Unique Insight into the Masterminds of the Second World War. And Paul, I want to talk a little bit about your background. Like Dr. Ponseti, who was from Spain, you are also an immigrant to the United States. Where did you come from?
Actually, Charity, that's one thing that really binded us together is our backgrounds. He came from Spain. He came in 1940, 1938, following the Spanish Civil War. And he was forced to flee Spain because he would have been killed had he stayed there. Thank God
he
came here.
He fought against
General
Franco.
Exactly, exactly. And I came from Lebanon. I was born in Lebanon, in Beirut, Lebanon. My father was a Christian missionary. And so my father was totally dedicated, just like Ponseti was dedicated for the babies. My dad was dedicated to winning souls for Christ. And therefore, he traveled a lot. In fact, we lived in Gaza. Gaza, right now the famous Gaza. I lived there for 10 years, and I've seen lots of bad things over there on both sides. When I met Dr. Ponseti, actually we talked a lot about our backgrounds, and the thing that really united us so much was our mutual love for this country. We were fascinated by being in America. We were excited about America and its ideals. And we thought that our relationship and our meeting together was providential because we shared so much in common. And we talked a lot about the beauty of this country, the values, the people, the constitution, the laws, the fairness, the pursuit of happiness, the equality. And in fact, as you know, you've read the book, so you know that in 1941, when he came to this country, he experienced symptoms of racism in Texas. And he was really very upset about that. And but then to see that a few decades later, that this country would elect the first African-American president, and what an impression that made on him. And I write about this in my book, what a revolution in his own time. And that actually shows the strength of character of the American public.
You do write about how both of you, on coming to the United States, had seen racism in some very ugly ways in the United States. But this was still a country that you were so devoted to, and he was so devoted to, in spite of its flaws. What do you think the United States really stood for Dr. Ponseti?
It stood for freedom, for hope, for potential of change, for positiveness. It stood for respect for the individual and for rights. And it was really a fertile ground for expression of thought. And that's what he loved most.
When you met Dr. Ponseti, as I mentioned, he had retired. He had been drawn back into his work with children, back into his work at the hospital at the University of Iowa. And it seems like almost in a way a strange time for him to form such a close bond with you, with a new friend, a man that had so many interests, so many passions, and was so devoted to his work. What do you think it was about the two of you that really connected?
Sure. I think he saw in me almost a replica of himself when he was young, a young man who was like a sponge. He wanted to learn. And I was so much attracted to him. And what happened actually, Charities, when he retired and spent 5 years getting more education, then he came back, published a book, and then the internet showed its face in 1990, okay? And then the internet is what made him all famous, because then all the mothers in the whole world started reading about his outcomes. And then suddenly his practice just flourished, and then he felt he had to come back and work full-time, and he did. He worked full-time. He saw patients every day. And then on October 13, 2009, I picked him up to come to work as usual. He came. He was 95 years old. He saw patients. Then he asked me to drop by his office to pick him up for lunch. I did. And that's where I found him, that he had a major stroke.
He had passed away at his desk.
At his desk.
At work at just age like, 95.
Exactly. It's just incredible, inspirational, magnificent testimony of his life.
The two of you talked about so many things. And he also guided you in your interests and your passions. And this book that you've written, as I mentioned, is much of it is about World War II. Why? Why have you chosen to write about these conversations that you had with Dr. Ponseti about World War II?
Very good question. It's because of the passion he created in me. I was always, from way back when I was a teenager, I was fascinated by statesmen who influence history, by great minds. That's why I was attracted to Dr. Ponseti, because he was a great mind. I rank him with the highest minds, even in World War II. With Churchill, with Stalin, with FDR. He was at that caliber. So he talked a lot about World War II because he lived it. He used to listen to the speeches by Churchill, by Stalin, by Hitler, by FDR when he was in Spain as a medical student. And therefore, he fed this in me. And it created a thirst that I pursued by reading a lot about Hitler, about Stalin, about the plight of the Jews in Europe, and I felt I was so full of this kind of knowledge I had to kind of relay it in my book, because it's something I love. It's a passion, and so I actually outlined the rise of power of Hitler. I outlined how Churchill was able to detect him from way back, and then how he eventually became prime minister in 1940, and then he was the one who guided his demise. I talk about Stalin and how Stalin was actually aligned with FDR and Churchill to conquer this devil and how they succeeded in doing that. And so World War II history became a passion for me. And until this day, even this before I came to see you, Charity, I was reading about World War II history. I just can never get bored with it.
What do you think your exchanges and your research and Dr. Ponsetti's insight can give to people that they couldn't get from another history of World War II?
Well, one thing that I try to do in my book is present the cream of the crop from my research. So what you have there is some revelations that very few people are aware of. I read lots of diaries that were written by people who lived during World War II. And I for example, the plight of the Jews fascinated me because actually they were rejected by everybody at that time. Boatloads of Jewish would leave Germany in 1939, 40, 41, and they will go to, let's say, they'll go to New York. And New York said, no, we won't accept you. Then they go to Cuba. Cuba would say, no, we won't accept you. They go to Brazil. No, we won't accept you. They go to Palestine. They say, no, we won't accept you. Many of them ended up going back to Germany, where, as they disembarked, they were beaten and sent to concentration camps. That was the state of the situation in that era. Look how things changed today. Thank God.
I want to return to Dr. Ponsetti, and we also have a call on the line from Jeff in Iowa City with a question that I don't know that you'll be able to answer, but I'm sure you'll have an interest. You've worked at the University of Iowa Hospitals for many years. You're
right.
Recently retired,
right.
Worked there as an administrator,
right.
And Jeff is on the line. Hi, Jeff.
Howdy.
Hi, what's your question?
Well, I want to first tell Paul that I'm glad he wrote the book. I think Dr. Ponsetti was maybe the greatest faculty member the university has had. He should be touted. He's up there with Van Allen or Paul Engel or Lozansky. And I'm wondering, I also hope to hear you talk about, as I understand it, he was a hero in the Spanish Civil War, and the way he died during the week that was commemorating him, that was such poetry. What a way to die. But I was wanting to know, are they going to name the University of Iowa's Children's Hospital that they're building now? They should be naming it after him. Are they going to do that?
Jeff, I'm all for what you just said. The people you mentioned here, the professors that you mentioned, were actually his inner circle too. And he was their equal in IQ and knowledge and prestige. And he deserves to have that building named after him. But as you know, with naming of buildings, a republic institution is all politics. You know, Ponsetti, as great as he was, he never made too much money. He never cared about money. I don't think he made over 100,000 at all in his life, while others would make 500,000. And sometimes he would complain to me about that. But I think this person deserves that kind of recognition that you mentioned, Jeff, and I think maybe you should lead an effort to have the Children's Hospital named after him, absolutely. And
Jeff,
I'll help you.
Jeff, thank you so much for your call. And the work that Dr. Ponsetti did, the Ponsetti method, of course, lives on, and many, many doctors use that around the world now. What do you think let's not entirely talk about his legacy, but do you feel like his name is well known, like people know his story?
Well, that's why I wrote the book, so that people would know his story other than the Ponsetti method. But we do have, as I mentioned in my book, many representatives throughout the world who promote his method. In fact, we have Dr. Stu Weinstein, who's in our faculty, Dr. Jose Mercuendi, Dr. Frederick Dietz. These are pediatric surgeons, and Dr. Ryan Ilgenfritz, who just joined us. They're all students of Dr. Ponsetti. And today, for example, Dr. Mercuendi is in Pakistan teaching the Ponsetti method. Dr. Weinstein goes to Vietnam often and China to teach the Ponsetti method. Dr. Dietz goes to Africa, and so forth. So he is very well known internationally, absolutely.
What do you think people should know about him other than his method?
Well, they should know what he taught me. And what he taught me is anytime you get a chance to help someone, do it. Anytime you get a chance to do good, do it. Always be truthful. Truth shall set you free, he said. And always look for ways to help others. He would sometimes spend hours and hours after work with his babies. He was obsessed with babies. He couldn't sleep at night if he knew that there was a baby hurting. And that's what really motivated him. And that's why he was able to live till age 95, almost 96, with such mental and physical vibrancy.
When you make decisions on a daily basis, do you often think, what would Dr. Ponseti have done?
Absolutely. In fact, I can't shake him off my consciousness. When I drink wine, I see his face in my wine bottle. When I go out playing tennis in City Park, I look and his house is right next door there, and sometimes I would see him tending his garden. He's always with me. I take walks with my dog. I talk to Dr. Ponseti. He is part of me. I'm blessed, so much blessed, by knowing him and being so intimately connected with him and his wife. Helena was very precious. And so, yes, absolutely, his memory lives in me.
How do you think you're different because of this friendship?
I'm much different because I took the attention out of my own self-interest, and now I'm directing my interests onto others. I am trying to think of ways now to establish things to help others less fortunate, whether it's the homeless or the poor. I have my family, my brothers, who are involved in orphanages and helping elderly people. You know, that's another big area that needs attention. And so he changed my whole values and my focus in life.
Will there be more conversations with Dr. Ponseti? Are you planning to write more about your relationship?
Yes. In fact, you know, I have so many ideas now. I was telling one of your assistants, I plan that my next book maybe is about Dr. Found, Ernie Found, who, as you know, lost his wife and daughter last year. And he's become a very close friend of mine. And his character is fascinating, the way he has dealt with this, and he's inspiring. And so, yeah, I will write more about Dr. Ponseti. I may have to divide this book in two. One about Ponseti and one about World War II. So I have many ideas.
All right. Well, Paul, thank you so much for talking with me today.
My pleasure, absolutely.
Paul Etri is the author of the new book, Ponseti and Paul, Conversations with the Legendary Ignacio Ponseti, Revealing a Unique Insight into the Masterminds of the Second World War. Talk of Iowa is produced by Dennis Reese, Emily Woodbury, and Sarah Bowden. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. We had production assistance today from Caitlin Fry. Podcasting and on-demand audio of Talk of Iowa are available at iowapublicradio.org. You can send us email, talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. I'm Charity Nebbe. Tomorrow on the show, wildlife biologist Jim Pease will talk about gifts for wildlife.